If you're interested in finding out what the latest science is on sports concussion and mild traumatic brain injury, you've come to the right place. Welcome to the March 2010 podcast on sports concussion and mild TBI, Myths and Facts. This is Valerie Stone from Answers About Competency, LLC. A recent high-profile case in New Jersey about a high school football player who died after a second concussion has brought a lot of media attention and legal attention to sports concussion and what is called second impact syndrome. What I'd like to do in this podcast is clarify some of the science of concussion, also known as mild traumatic brain injury, and spell out some myths and facts. A lot of personal injury attorneys are looking closely at schools and teams' liability in cases of sports-related concussions, especially where there's been a return to play after a first concussion. Also, legislatures and school districts are hurrying to put policies in place to try to avoid catastrophic outcomes for athletes. In such a climate, understanding the science is important. Policy and law should be grounded in the best science of the time. Before I get started talking about the science, I do want to say that for anyone who has lost someone to a catastrophic brain injury or has had someone close to them disabled by a catastrophic brain injury, I extend my deep sympathies. It is terrible to lose someone you love suddenly or to have someone you love suddenly changed because of an accident. It's natural and human to ask whether the accident could have been prevented. For attorneys who are dealing with such bereaved families on either side of a lawsuit, I recommend imagining how you would feel if you lost a child and being compassionate in all your communications on either side of the issue. Let's talk about the science of mild traumatic brain injury and concussion. If you don't know much about traumatic brain injury in general, you might want to go back and listen to the first half of our longer podcast, Protecting Clients with Brain Injury, for a general overview. It's under Attorney Resources at www.assesscompetency.com. Throughout this podcast, I'm going to use the abbreviation TBI for traumatic brain injury. First, let's go over a couple of definitions. Concussion and mild traumatic brain injury are the same thing. A change in mental status that occurs after a blow to the head. That's the definition, a change in mental status that occurs after a blow to the head. The change could be confusion, disorientation, memory loss, or loss of consciousness. It doesn't have to include loss of consciousness. In fact, a large number of mild traumatic brain injuries do not involve loss of consciousness, but they're still traumatic brain injuries. They are still concussions. Generally, doctors and neuropsychologists define a TBI in terms of score on the Glasgow Coma Scale, extent of any loss of consciousness, and the extent of any memory loss after the injury, called post-traumatic amnesia. A mild TBI, same thing as a concussion, has a loss of consciousness of anywhere from 0 seconds to 20 or 30 minutes, post-traumatic amnesia of less than 24 hours, and a Glasgow Coma Scale score of 13 to 15, which usually means the person is fairly alert and responsive pretty soon after the injury. A short handout about the Glasgow Coma Scale is available on our website too, again under Attorney Resources. The second definition is second impact syndrome. This is a very rare outcome following TBI, in which the brain swells so much that it's life-threatening. This condition is also called malignant cerebral edema, where malignant just means that it's bad and edema just means swelling. So those are jargon terms. Blows to the head are not the only possible cause of brain swelling, but they are one cause. The idea behind the term second impact syndrome is that some people believe that this catastrophic fatal swelling of the brain is more likely to happen if a person has a second concussion when they've not fully recovered from the first concussion. However, this belief isn't really consistent with current medical evidence. In fact, many such cases of catastrophic brain swelling occur after a single impact. So this leads us to our first myth. Myth: second impact syndrome is a well-established medical fact and is likely to happen if someone goes back into play too soon. That seems to be false. Fact: this catastrophic brain swelling is a very rare event, and there is currently no evidence linking it to second impacts as opposed to first impacts. If second impact syndrome were a common outcome, you would expect to find examples of it in large surveys of athletes. Especially when you studied athletes who rushed back into the game, you would expect to see several examples of second impact syndrome. There are researchers who have studied athletes and their return to play. Let me quote from an article about football players and concussion in the Journal of the International Neuropsychological Society that came out late in 2009. Begin quote. The National Center for Catastrophic Sport Injury Research at the University of North Carolina maintains a database of sport-related injuries to the brain and spinal cord that result in permanent disability or death. Over the past 10 American football seasons, from 1997 to 2006, there have been 50 cases of permanent disability, disability at 2 to 3 months post-injury, and 38 deaths due to cerebral injuries at all levels of play, from sandlot through professional. The overall incidence of death or disability is still quite low. The risk of permanent disability or death as a result of cerebral injury in American football is therefore approximately 1 for every 20,500 player seasons. There's one season in American football, and therefore a player season represents annual risk per athlete. For a squad size of 100 players, this would translate to one such injury on average every 205 seasons. End quote. These are not the numbers you would see if second impact syndrome were likely to happen. In fact, most of those 38 deaths in football over those 10 years were not from cerebral swelling, but from bleeding in the brain known as subdural hematoma. Very dangerous. Resulting from, and I quote again, quote, the immediate consequences of a single traumatic brain injury. End quote. Another study published just last year in the journal Neurosurgery looked at the effects of a symptom-free waiting period before return to play, studied from 1999 to 2004. Out of 16,624 player seasons, 635 athletes got concussions, or about 4%. 562 athletes ended up in the study. Symptom-free in the study was not just based on the athlete's self-report, because we know athletes are sometimes biased to say that they're okay so they can get back in the game. Symptom-free was assessed objectively. Cognitive functioning was assessed by a neuropsychologist, and balance and postural stability were assessed objectively, too. So of these 562 athletes, 339 observed a symptom-free waiting period ranging from 1 day to more than 7 days before they returned to play. The other 223 athletes did not have a symptom-free waiting period before returning to play. These 223 athletes returned to play an average of about 1 day before having a full resolution of their symptoms. So what happened to these athletes who were taking a greater risk of a second impact? Well, they experienced no adverse events. When they were examined 45 days and again 90 days after their first injury, they had no more symptoms than the 339 athletes who had waited to be symptom-free before returning to play. What was true of the group that started to play before their symptoms were completely resolved was that their symptoms took a little bit longer to get better than in the group that had waited until they were symptom-free to return to play. So again, these are not the results you would expect to see if something like second impact syndrome were likely to happen after a concussion. Any parent or team or school who has lost someone knows how devastating such a catastrophic outcome can be. Anyone would want to prevent such an outcome, of course. The question is whether it is really possible to prevent such deaths altogether, short of banning high impact sports like football completely. So there are risks. This brings us to another myth. Myth: second impact syndrome is the biggest risk that athletes face from blows to the head during sports. That's not necessarily true. Fact. Instead, research on risk from sports concussion and mild traumatic brain injury shows that it seems to be first impacts that are most likely to lead to death or severe disability. The problem is that when someone hits his or her head and becomes confused or disoriented or even loses consciousness for a bit, it's not always immediately clear how severe the brain injury is. What happens at the scene of the accident is usually a good indicator of how severe the brain injury is, but in some rare cases, someone may have a more severe condition, such as a bleed in the brain or swelling that can be very serious. even though they don't lose consciousness for a long time and even if they don't go into a coma. So I can give an example of a man who participated in one of my research studies. He was in the military in the 1970s, and during a training exercise, he dove into a ditch and hit his head on a rock. He was only knocked out for a couple of minutes and only disoriented for a short while. The military doc saw him and thought he was fine, told him to take some aspirin and go back to training. Scientists and doctors, remember, this was the 1970s, scientists and doctors simply did not know as much about brain injury back then. This man never had another concussion or head injury, but after that injury, he started having trouble getting along in the military. He was having trouble concentrating and remembering orders. He suffered a personality change, going from a model soldier to one who is often socially inappropriate and insubordinate. These are the symptoms of a moderate to severe traumatic brain injury, but he had no idea that this was his problem. It was only several years later, when he went to see a doctor in the Veterans Administration about headaches, that they did a CT scan of his brain. Then they discovered that about a third of his frontal lobes were severely damaged. No one knew, based on what had happened on the day he was injured, that his brain injury was that severe. Now, he is very lucky. Although he has had difficulties in life because of his brain injury, he survived. But it's possible to have a life-threatening brain injury and not realize it right away. In rare cases, the signs of a more severe brain injury only become evident later, after a concussion. That's why wait and see is a good policy. So one excellent reason to wait before returning an athlete to play after a blow to the head is to see whether any signs of a more severe brain injury emerge. This is the reason to wait, not necessarily second impact syndrome, but to make sure that the first impact did not cause a moderate or severe brain injury. This is a good reason for many emerging regulations and legislation, such as the Zachary Lysette Law in Washington State, to require a certified healthcare provider to examine athletes with concussion and approve their return to play. The problem may not be second impact syndrome, but may be first impacts that are more severe than the player, parents, or athletic trainers realize at the time the first concussion occurs. Tragic and catastrophic brain injuries can occur in sports. The best we know right now from scientific research, however, is that catastrophic brain injuries are no more likely to occur as a result of a second impact than they are to occur as a result of a first impact. The only way to completely 100% prevent such rare events is to avoid head impacts altogether, which means no sports, no skiing, no driving, no bicycling, no running, no going up and down stairs, no falling down, no getting your head near solid objects. You get the picture. The problem in liability cases is knowing whether the catastrophic brain injury occurred as a result of returning to play too soon, or whether the catastrophic brain injury occurred simply as a result of being in play in the first place and hitting the head. Now, having said that, there are good medical reasons to be conservative, to wait and make sure that the brain injury is not more severe, and to reduce the possibility of multiple concussions. If parents and schools feel safer doing so, they can keep athletes out of play for anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months after a concussion to hedge their bets that recovery is complete and that the person suffered only a mild brain injury rather than a more severe one. I encourage people to look at the website cokidswithbraininjury.org to get some good guidelines on concussion management developed through the REAP program by Karen McAvoy. In particular, it's very important for athletes to rest in the first few days after a concussion, not to have too much exertion. Athletes seem to recover from concussion more quickly if they take it easy and do not return to play until they're symptom-free. Finally, and I hope this is reassuring to parents, the best we know from scientific research right now is that more than 90% of people who have a single, uncomplicated, mild traumatic brain injury, also known as concussion, will recover fully and completely. It's important to remember that brain injury doesn't necessarily mean permanent brain damage. Just like you can sprain an ankle and it will get better and you can use it again, same thing with a mild traumatic brain injury. The brain does recover. Just a reminder about terminology, concussion and mild traumatic brain injury are the same thing. I'll talk about the difference between complicated and uncomplicated mild TBI in a separate podcast in May. A complicated mild TBI is more severe. So you might come to another myth. So then it's fine to have multiple concussions, right? It's no problem to have more than one concussion or mild TBI. Sadly, the evidence is mounting that that is not true either. Fact, although second concussions have not been scientifically shown to lead to fatal brain swelling and death, multiple mild TBIs do seem to have negative effects in the long run. A scientific review of studies that was just published this month in March 2010 in the Journal of the International Neuropsychological Society detailed how multiple mild TBIs can have long-term negative effects on cognition, particularly on memory, attention, and what we call executive functioning, which you can think of as complex problem solving. If you're not familiar with the term executive functioning, you can download our PDF file, the Jargon Dictionary, available on our website under Attorney Resources. In the studies that were reviewed in this article, the average number of mild TBIs ranged from 2 to 3, and the period of time between mild TBIs was generally 4 to 9 months. So we're not talking about a case where someone gets a concussion and then goes back into play a few days later, has another concussion. We're talking about mild TBIs that are fairly well spaced apart. However, even though there's been time for recovery in between these TBIs, it does seem that having multiple TBIs does cause problems with cognition in the long run. To summarize, repeatedly banging your head is probably not good for you in the long run. Even if it's not catastrophic, wouldn't anyone want to have their full cognitive abilities later in life? Finally, one more factoid for our listeners. If you're wondering how hard you have to hit your head to get a concussion, there is some research on that using devices inside helmets to measure force. It looks like it takes about 85 to 100 Gs to produce a mild TBI or concussion. That's about the force you would get running into a brick wall at 20 to 25 miles per hour in a car. It can also happen while running down a football field and falling down. It's probably not going to happen if you're fixing something under the sink and stand up too quickly and bump your head. Now, does this mean a concussion or brain injury cannot happen with less force? No, it doesn't necessarily mean that. These are average values, which are true most of the time. It's always possible that if a blow to the head twists the head around in just the wrong way, what we call rotational forces, that the brain can be affected. Thanks for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast. I've talked about several scientific research articles in this podcast. If you would like citations or copies of those articles emailed to you, drop me an email, vestone@assesscompetency.com. Information in this podcast is up to date as of March 2010. Under Attorney Resources on our website, I've also provided a link to a Sports Illustrated article about the tragic case in New Jersey that has ended up in a lawsuit, and I've provided a link to some concussion management guidelines developed through the REAP program here in Colorado, cokidswithbraininjury.org. For more information about brain injury and to find out about continuing education workshops we offer, go to our website, www.assesscompetency.com. which we will shortly be moving to www.aboutheadinjury.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next month.